Dobar dan i dobrodošli u još jednu epizodu Bezbedne priče. Današnji gost je Kristina Šulc, koja je licencirani socijalni radnik i forenzički intervjuer. Ona ima dugogodišnje iskustvo u radu sa zlostavljanom decom i danas će podeliti neke od dobrih praksi sa nama. Nadam se da ćete uživati u današnjoj epizodi.
So, Kristina, thank you for agreeing on this interview, on this conversation.
I am very happy to be here. Your country is beautiful and your people and food and music. So, very happy to be here.
It means a lot. The conversation we will be having, it is really difficult, but I think it is really important for everybody to hear. And our listeners are parents and educators and professionals working closely with children. So it is really important for them to hear all of the good practices, especially coming from another country, so they can implement that in their job. But for those who don't actually know, for example, parents, what exactly is child sexual abuse? Can you define it?
Yes, and agreed. I think, you know, the topic of sexual abuse is really difficult, and a lot of people don't want to hear about it, and it's a scary thing for some people to hear about, but it's important that it be talked about. So what is child sexual abuse? That can be defined as any sexual act between an adult and a minor. It can also be any sexual act involving a minor and an older minor or an older child.
Mm-hmm.
And that could include some sort of coercion, force. And it also can include non-sexual acts. So, for example, exposure to pornography, voyeurism, exhibitionism.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can also include things like online or through phones or internet, inappropriate messages, those sorts of things.
This one's really difficult, and it connects to it. Some people believe that those things, child sexual abuse, only happen in the movies or only happen to somebody else, not their child, because their child would know better, know to how to defend themselves. And that is such a taboo, especially in our country. So we always are making sure to stress that it is important to know everything about it, because it can happen to anybody and everybody. So I'm interested, can you tell us some signs that are pointing or showing that the child may be sexually abused?
Sure. And just to reiterate what you said, a lot of mm-hmm. people think this is not something that happens to us. It wouldn't happen within our family. That stuff just happens in the movies or to other families.
Exactly.
But the fact is that this can happen in anywhere, any family. And so we need to be aware. We need to be educated about what sexual abuse is and what some of the signs may be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's important to know also that there may not be any signs. And some kids have just really figured out a way to manage what has been handed to them.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, again, they don't want to tell. Most kids do not tell right away. They keep the secret for many years or sometimes even decades. And so, again, they may have figured out a way to what we call compartmentalization. Something bad has happened to them like this, but they have figured out a way to just separate it from their outwardly, they may appear just normal.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, some children may exhibit some behavioral indicators. And that can look different for younger children or older children. Some things to look out for in younger children could be things like nightmares, bedwetting, regression in certain things like somebody that has been potty trained and maybe they've regressed.
Mm-hmm.
Other things like exhibiting kind of unusual fear, or maybe you've seen a decline in a child's academics.
Mm-hmm.
It could be maybe you see runaways with older kids, or even self-destructive behaviors like cutting.
Yeah, self-harm.
Self-harm. So it can be a variety of things. But again, it could be no signs at all.
Yeah, I can understand that because, well, dealing with that, even as an adult, we try to not to remember all of the traumatic things that happened to us. I can only imagine what goes in the child's head. But as an adult, caregivers, educators, or parents, how should they act in such situations? Because that's something that parents ask us a lot as an organization. What could we do or should we do to prevent this from happening? And can you tell us something about that? And also, I'm interested in who are the perpetrators in most cases?
Well, I'll tell you what, if we go outside to this block outside and look around, there's no way to tell. You go out in public, there would be no way to identify a perpetrator, and that's what makes it even more very difficult. You can't just pick them out from a crowd. Perpetrators of sexual abuse can be teachers, can be doctors, can be priests, clergymen. It could be males and females, anybody. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, is there anything the parents can do to prevent child sexual abuse?
Yes, so there's things that we can do on different levels, from us as parents, us as just concerned adults, different organizations. And so with parents, when we talk about child abuse prevention, sexual abuse prevention, it really starts with talking to children at a young age, okay? And kids as young as 1-2 years old. And first thing is, let's identify the different body parts, and let's have proper names for body parts. Again, you don't want to have any confusion if a child does make a statement about disclosure. Be very clear. Name your body parts just like you would your eyes, your nose, your ears. A lot of times that's even a topic within homes. You don't feel comfortable talking about things involving sex and body parts, but you need to do it. And again, age appropriate, right? And being clear about, you know, those are special parts on you, and nobody is supposed to touch those parts. And be clear about who. And, you know, in certain circumstances, there might be a doctor that may need to look or examine. But even mommy and daddy should not be touching you. We can maybe help if needed for wiping, if needed. But nobody should be touching you on those parts. And if anybody ever does touch you, let's talk about what to do in that situation. And again, it's not just a one-time conversation. These are conversations that should be frequently had. And starting with having really those conversations early on about body parts and other important, it's just having open communication with your children at various ages. And they need to be able to know that they have somebody to go to in case something ever does happen. The thing is, usually they don't want to come to somebody they know and love, right? They want to protect that person. And sometimes they feel that they're going to be in trouble or somebody will be mad at them. But again, they need to know that they have a safe person to come to and be able to talk to about these things.
Yeah. I just remembered that we had one child asking us about what will happen to them because they are afraid. Yes. They didn't disclosure that earlier because, well, that's my parent and he is not the good parent, but he is in a way taking care of me. So what will happen to me if I disclosure? So that the better version of this situation is for me not to disclose. And that's a terrible thing and terrible situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we know that, again, kids, again, there's different reasons why kids don't tell. One of the predictors, if you will, is the closer the relationship that the child is to the perpetrator, the more likely they're going to delay in telling. And that is because there's usually some sort of bond or some sort of established relationship that child has with that person. And a lot of times there's a lot of positive parts, a lot of positive aspects of the relationship, and there likely was some sort of grooming involved. And if we're talking about the perpetrator being somebody like a parent or a caregiver, that makes it even more difficult to say, well, what is that child going to do, right? You tell on this person, what is supposed to happen to them? And so that's a very legitimate concern or fear of having to tell. But again, you just, having to assure a child that you, I will do everything I can do to protect you, and I will believe you, and we'll figure out what to do.
One thing popped in my mind that I didn't actually thought of asking, but right now, what happens if a child is being groomed by the parent and doesn't know that it is being abused?
Sure.
Like that is a part of their relationship, part of their how they are functioning day to day. So they are not exactly aware. What happened then?
Yeah. And so again, if this is a child that's all they know and nobody's talked to them about, people shouldn't be touching you like that. That makes it even more difficult. The hope is that child would have some other trusted adult that they can go to or talk to about it. But yeah, you're right. That's a very difficult situation when the person that's doing harm to you is a person that's supposed to be taking care of you and protecting you. Again, I think that's where teaching kids and educating them.
And I'm so glad that you touched up on the subject of body safety, because here in Serbia, it is not very common for parents to talk about body parts because it is a shameful conversation. So they choose not to, and they are naming body parts on different, giving them different nicknames or just to make it less shameful. And then the children don't know, actually, and they're perceiving that as a shameful thing to say, so they don't say that, they don't disclosure that. So we had to make some rules for the parents they could bring home and teach children about the body safety. And the thing we came the idea we got is that intimate parts are the parts covered by your swimsuit. So we told that to the parents. And that worked, fortunately. But I think that we should talk about it more.
Absolutely. Was again, if a child has come forward to tell and they don't feel comfortable to even talking to because they've been trained, they've been taught, don't talk about those parts, that's going to be very difficult. So I think that's a good step in the right direction is, you know, the parts of your body that are covered by a bathing suit. But again, taking it the next step, and that is treating those parts like any other part on your body. Mm-hmm. We need to get to the point where we're comfortable talking about these things.
And do you maybe have some advices? How should parents approach this subject? How should they start when the child is very young? And how should they behave when the child is, for example, 9-10 years old?
Yeah. So again, we talked about as younger kids providing proper names for different body parts.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as they get older, they're going to have a little bit more of a developmentally a better understanding about pretty soon they'll need to learn about sex, what actually happens with sex in the body. And from what I understand, it's about 8 years old. I know that might seem young for some parents, but really understanding, you know, how babies are made and how that happens. And and then, of course, there's this whole category of online safety. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. So. One question about teachers and the people who are working closely with children. So if a child is maybe experiencing sexual abuse at home, what is the position of a educator, for example? Should they do something about it? And what do you think they should do? How should they approach this subject?
Well, I believe that teachers have a very unique opportunity to be able to help a child that may be experiencing abuse. And if there is, obviously, if a child comes forward to a teacher and says, this has happened to me, of course, you're going to need to report and take mm-hmm. the proper steps. And But a teacher, again, has an opportunity. They're with kids every day. They know kind of a child's baseline behavior. And if a child is suddenly just different, just acting different, or maybe they seem withdrawn, depressed, or just a little different, I think it's warranted to, you know, pull the kid aside and say, hey, I'm just noticed. How are things going? Are you, and, you know, sometimes that is showing an interest. That they're showing the child you have a concern and interest in them. And, you know, again, having open conversations with kids about, hey, I'm here if you ever want to talk about anything or if you need somebody to talk to, because not all kids have a trusted adult at home. So, again, teachers have a unique opportunity to possibly be that person.
And I can imagine that their job is really hard because, well, they do not have only one child at the classroom. They have, for example, 20.
Sure.
And paying attention to everybody's behavior can be really hard. And I can only imagine that they could feel guilt if they found out that something happened, but they didn't notice anything different in their behavior. So do you have some special advices for educators? Should they pay... At what things should they pay attention? Because having 20 children at the same time can be overwhelming.
Sure. Well, again, I think if a teacher notices that a child who may have been doing well academically, suddenly there's a decline, or maybe if there's known maybe some stressors happening at home, again, checking in with the child periodically. And, you know, I think a lot of times people in that have children that have waited to disclose abuse, there often is a feeling of, oh my gosh, why didn't he or she tell me? I get that a lot with parents. They say, why would they have not told me? And some parents that have said, you tell me if anybody ever touches you. You know, there's situations where they have been educated and they may not necessarily tell. And you have to understand that the child likely is, you know, again, there's a lot of fear of disclosing, again, fear of getting in trouble, fear of disrupting the family, fear of people being mad at them, fear of people thinking that they were somehow part of, you know, the abuse. So, again, we know, and actually the research shows there's been cases of in which we know the abuse has occurred. So where there has been external corroborative evidence. And even children, when asked directly, many kids will still deny. So again, there's reasons for that. And it could be maybe fear of not feeling supported by that person, in particular a parent. So if there's a fear or a perception that a parent maybe would not respond appropriately or not be supportive, those kids are going to be more likely to not disclose. So,
but you mentioned one thing that I think is really helpful is reducing one-on-one time.
Yes.
So can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So again, we know that sexual abuse occurs, 80% of the time, at least 80% of the time, it's when that child is alone, one-on-one with an adult or more powerful or older child. So if we look at that, we figure out ways to reduce that individual one-on-one time. And again, that might be something that offends people as well, but if we know what the risks are, again, we're looking just to reduce those risks. So again, just limiting long alone time with other individuals.
Another difficult situation is when a child discloses to a parent. The reaction of a parent could be bad. They could be angry or disappointed or really, really scared. So they could say, how could you let somebody do something to you? Why didn't you run? Why didn't you say no? And the child can shut down, and feel like, I should not have told my mom about it. Well, I should have kept quiet. So do you have any advices? How should parents react when a child discloses something like that?
Great question. Thank you. That's really important. So we know that when the child finally has the courage to come forward and tell, we know that the person that they choose to tell, and usually with younger kids, it's probably going to be a parent or a mother, mm-hmm. and then older kids may generally tell like a same age peer or a friend. But when we're talking about a child making a disclosure to a parent, they finally made that decision, they're telling, the response of that parent is going to be very important. If that parent appears to be upset or not believing or, you know, questioning the child's credibility, that child is going to be more likely to just stop talking. They may then maybe minimize, and worst case, they may end up what we call recanting. So they may take back. It's like, oh, never mind, it didn't happen. Because if they feel that, oh gosh, what happened? What am I doing? This is, I'll just take it back. It's just easier that way. And that's not good because the abuse could potentially continue. So again, I think parents need to understand their response, just starting with believing, listen to the child and allow them to explain what happened. We also encourage them to not ask a lot of leading and direct questions. Mm-hmm. But you say, I'm hear you, and I'm going to do everything I can to help you. And then you report. You report in our country. It would be reporting to what we call child welfare services mm-hmm. or law enforcement. And so reporting to an investigative agency and let them handle it. There's, you know, professionals there that will take it from there. So, again, starting with believing.
We don't have many professionals in our country that are doing the job that you are doing mm-hmm. because we don't have that specific role of forensic mm-hmm. interviewer. So I can imagine in the future there are some plans for introducing that kind of role. And if somebody who is watching, a young person that maybe could find themselves in this position, what is your advice to them if they choose to do the job that you are doing?
Yeah. Well, so the job of a forensic interviewer?
Yeah.
Yes. So this is a pretty unique, specialized job that we have in interviewing children or developmentally delayed adults. And it's usually at the request of law enforcement or child welfare services. And it is an interview that is done we consider the child's development, so it's a developmentally appropriate, and it needs to be legally sound, needs to be able to potentially stand up in court. And there is a method of gathering factual information about abuse or witness to violence, and we use what we call research-informed techniques, and mm-hmm. I could talk more about what those are. And it really, a forensic interview is really a tool and part of a larger investigative process. And so, again, well, historically, children would have to talk to multiple people, multiple agencies, and we know that's not best practice for a child to have to repeat their story and, you know, really could potentially compromise the integrity of an investigation without multiple interviews. So having somebody who's trained and be able to ask the questions in a way that are non-leading and appropriate, that's really considered best practice. And so, again, during an interview, our goal is not to confirm that the abuse occurred. That's not our goal. Our goal, again, is to find out if the abuse happened. The abuse may not have happened. But again, just to interview the child in a way that's trauma-informed, so trauma-sensitive, mm-hmm. and be able to ask questions in a way that would elicit the best responses from the child and ideally narrative responses. And one of the ways we do that is through our question type. We try to utilize really good open-ended questions and, again, avoiding those leading questions. Another thing we do, we want to have a really accurate information and as much information as possible. And we do, one of the other things that we do is we give the child instructions. So we say, if I ask you a question and you don't know the answer, just let me know you don't know, and then mm-hmm. I'll ask the question a different way. And then we give an example of that. Or we let the child know they have permission to correct the interviewer if the interviewer says something that's wrong or makes a mistake, we want them to know it's okay to correct us. It's very important that they correct us. And again, if they don't understand a question, all of those things help to reduce communication errors that could naturally occur between a child and adult talking to one another. And again, we do our best to formulate questions in a way that are understandable. We also need to keep in mind that children, by the time they come for an interview, they likely have told somebody already, and that's mm-hmm. how this came to the attention of law enforcement or child welfare to begin with. And so when they come to an interview, usually it's the first time that they'll provide the information in such, you know, elaborate detail. But in some cases, a child may just, you know, they may give a little bit, they may be unwilling to provide a lot of information, and that's okay. You know, we need to know when to kind of push a little bit more and know when to back off. Again, being sensitive to the trauma that the child may have experienced, and understand that when it comes to disclosure, it's really a process, right? It's not something that you do it in one day and it's done. A disclosure can be over a lifetime, really. Mm-hmm. And so, again, forensic interview, we do our best to gather as much information about the acts or the various events that may have occurred. And, I think that's kind of the crux of a forensic interview.
And I'm interested, maybe I'm asking this for myself. As a person who is working with the people who survived such horrendous mm-hmm. things, especially children. I believe that all of the stories stuck with you. They are stuck mm-hmm. with you, and you maybe be thinking about it for the rest of your day, not just your work day, but when you spend your time at home, you'll be thinking about all of the injustice that happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested, what do you do for your mental health so you could be better at your job?
Thank you for asking that. That's a really important question. And there is recognition in the field that we are, as interviewers, as advocates, as law enforcement and prosecutors, all of our multidisciplinary team, we are exposed to maybe secondary exposure to trauma by hearing the stories. And for some that do have to look at pictures or conduct a forensic examination, mm-hmm. It can be, you know, I don't know that our brains were necessarily designed to take in such information, but it is important to figure out a way to separate work from your personal life. We have a really good team. It's important to have good team members and good leadership to be able to talk through. If you had a really yucky case, mm-hmm. like let's talk about it. Let's talk how has it affect you? It's a field that's definitely not for everybody, but it's a field that's very rewarding as well. We have at our center, we have what is offered to us, because our organization does recognize the impact this could have on our work and potentially cause burnout. We have a specialist, a licensed clinical social worker. He's a mm-hmm. therapist that does come in monthly, and he sits down with the staff and does what's called reflexive supervision. And so, again, gives opportunities for us to talk about, you know, how are you doing today, and how have you been these past weeks, and is there anything in particular that has kind of stuck with you or bothered you? And then we also have the ability to speak one-on-one with him if needed. We're co-located with another larger agency, and they also recognize the impact on that the work has on us. And they offer like wellness days, and, you know, let's talk about self-care. You know, what do you offering different activities for self-care. And we encourage, like I encourage my staff to also engage outside of work. Do things that are going to make you feel good, mm-hmm. right? Leave work at work and, you know, focus on you and your family and things that are healthy too, right? So exercise and hobbies and that sort of thing. That's important too.
Yeah, and I read somewhere, because I was looking for advices, and I read somewhere, well, you will build resilience. And I thought to myself, well, I think this is the one field that you could not build resilience in, because you will never get used to the cases. Because, for example, doctors, when they see mm-hmm. blood, they are not scared or mm-hmm. Stressed anymore after some time because they are used to it. But you can never get used to seeing child abuse because that's something so stressful that you cannot build resilience. Yeah. I don't know if I'm right, but I believe that in my heart.
Well, I think there are some that say you become desensitized after you have talked to many kids, but it's still there. Occasionally there are cases that just really, whoa, it kind of takes your breath away. And so again, you have to know when to, sometimes it is not the right job for you. Sometimes it's time to move on to another position. But again, I think many of the people I work with really have a passion for it. And a lot of us have been doing it for a long time. So I've been doing it for 20 years. And what I tell people is that, it's hard. But once it starts to feel like work, then that might be sort of a clue, like, okay, mm-hmm. maybe that's time to move on. But you just have to be, it takes effort. You know that you do what you can do, and you just hope that, you are making a difference. And so that also helps.
Thank you for this conversation. I tried to reflect on the things you said at a conference because it was really important for me, for our listeners who were not able to attend, to hear something from you because I think it's really important, and especially because we don't have so many forensic interviewers here in our country. So they have some good practices to look up to. So it is really meaningful, and I'm really thankful for having you here in my podcast because I think it will inspire a lot of people who are maybe thinking about their career change or they're wanting to change direction in their career. Maybe they will look up to you and see that you are changing young people's lives every day, and that you look so certain and you look so confident in your role. And I think that is important. You don't have, like, you are having any doubts about your job. And I think that's really important, and that makes you passionate, and that makes your job good. And I think that children who are working with you, with you being so calm and collected, that it helps them to survive this on easier. Well, there's no easier path on when you're surviving trauma, but with you in their life, I think it is easier.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I will say that, you know, kids, well, people often say, well, I can't believe you would do this work. You know, that's, isn't it horrible? Other people have said that, right? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, you know what, considering what many of these kids have experienced and that they're so brave to be able to come tell their story, I mean, to me, that's inspiring. And if they can sit there and be able to tell their deepest, darkest secret and this horrible thing that happened, and if I can be that person to be able to help them talk through it with their words, of course, and, you know, be somebody that it can be genuine with them and a listener, you know, I feel privileged to be able to be able to hear their experience. And the other thing I want to say is, you know, this, it really takes a team of people, the multidisciplinary team. And what I say is, you know, it amazes me of the horrible things that people can do to a child, but it really amazes me the things that people will do for a child. And so you look at these amazing people that all really have a shared purpose in helping children, and I don't know, I'm inspired by them as well. So I'm grateful to work with a lot of my team as well. Going back to keeping that open communication with kids, I think also is, you know, at some point you're not going to be able to be around your child all the time, right? At some point they get older, they're going to be going out and doing more activities. And so I think it's fair to just continue having conversations. Like, tell me about your outing and tell me about the people that were there. And were there things that happened that, you know, made you feel uncomfortable or uncertain about? And, you know, some may think it's an interrogation, but it's really just a conversation. So continue those conversations. Again, being careful to that one-on-one time, reducing that, you know, limit the number of people that have that individual one-on-one time. And be careful. We talk about perpetrators. Oftentimes people think it's adults are the ones that are doing this, only adults. But we know that up to 40% of perpetrators are juvenile. So they're, mm-hmm. you know, maybe older children. And so be careful about one-on-one time with juveniles as well, as minors as well. And, you know, if going back to some of the tactics that groomers, you know, perpetrators do in grooming and, you know, identifying their victim, mm-hmm. building trust with that child, figuring out ways to isolate them and have alone time. The same goes for, you know, if somebody pays particular special interest in your child and is seeking that one-on-one time and, you know, asking to take that child in certain outings, and that goes for older children as well. So again, just be careful about it and say, well, how about I come along? or who else will be joining? And again, people may think you're being paranoid, but you're just figuring out ways to reduce the risk, right? And what I'm going to say next might be offensive to some people, but, you know, when it comes to if you have a choice for caretakers, you know, mm-hmm. choose a female caretaker, and apologize for those male caretakers that, you know, really have a genuine
intentions.
Genuine intentions. But again, you know, if we're looking at reducing risk, I mean, most perpetrators are male. And we talk about not just at home, but also a community and schools and community youth serving organizations and things that can be done also to reduce risk. Hopefully they have certain policies and procedures in place that also prevent or avoid the one-on-one time. And if there's a group of kiddos, hopefully there's, you know, maybe two adults or mm-hmm. two people supervising. And so, you know, hopefully organizations have practices in place. And again, we talk about situations involving children really should be observable, right? Mm-hmm. And intervenable, right? You need to be able to observe it and intervene.
Can you tell us more about the children who are more prone to be victims of child sexual abuse? So who are the children who are, more likely to be victims?
Sure. So as far as children that may be at higher risk for sexual abuse would be, well, females are going to be a little higher risk than males. We know that children that have had a prior history of child maltreatment or abuse, they may mm-hmm. be higher risk. Children that live in a home where neither of their biological parents are in the home, so children that are maybe in foster care or living maybe with other family members, they may be at higher risk. Other familial risk would include maybe parents that have history of substance abuse or mental health problems, domestic violence, and homes where there's poverty or lower socioeconomic status or education, lower education. And other individual or child factors, children who are delayed or have a mental or physical mm-hmm. delay, they're going to be more vulnerable and potentially more at risk. Children with behavioral delinquent behaviors, mm-hmm. Those children you may see will be a higher risk for child sexual abuse.
Christina, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me. I learned a lot, not just from this conversation, but from your presentation at our conference. it was really important for me, because doing this job, it is meaningful to have to look at this from aspects of a lot of different people. So meeting you was meaningful for me because I learned a lot, and I hope you had a great time in Serbia.
I had a wonderful time. Thank you so much. And thank you to you and your team that are all that you're doing for kids. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ovo je bila još jedna epizoda Bezbedne priče. Nadam se da ste naučili nešto novo. Do sljedeće epizode zapratite nas na društvenim mrežama, pogotovo na Instagram stranici Bezbedna priča, gdje možete da pronaćete isječke iz svih prethodnih podcasta. Vidimo se!